Astronomy Cast, episode 673, How to See Satellites or Avoid Them. Welcome to Astronomy Cast, your weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. I'm Fraser Cain, the publisher of Universe Today. With me is Dr. Pamela Gay, a senior scientist for the Planetary Science Institute and the director of CosmoQuest. Hey, Pamela, how you doing?
I am doing well. I appear to be spending my day amused at the antics of artificial intelligence, and I feel like I need to do a PSA that if you have that new Samsung phone with the 100X and you take an image of the moon, it's not actually the moon that you photographed. Well, you did photograph the moon, and now it's giving you somebody else's picture of the moon, because that's how Samsung's AI is rocking.
Now, is that true?
Yeah,
because I've heard that confirmation is also suspect. So, like press photos sharing to show what the moon looks like. I mean, The impression I get is that it's doing AI upscaling on your pictures. So it might not necessarily be somebody else's picture, but it is attempting to upscale the picture that you've taken.
So the test that was done, was someone downloaded a picture of the moon, degraded it, blurred it out, and displayed it on a monitor, and then took a picture of what they displayed on the monitor. And the phone came back with something that was containing information that was not in the original picture.
Yeah, that sounds like AI upscaling to me. And they do that. I mean, they smooth out your image. They smooth out your picture.
But then it added resolution.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what the upscaling is, right? It's Photoshop. So that's people want better pictures. And my phone, my Google phone totally messes with the shadows and the light areas to try and balance the picture. It'll remove wrinkles on your face. So we're deeply into this world where the pictures that you take are the pictures that you want, not the pictures that you took, I think is where we're getting to with all of this kind of stuff.
I don't like this. This is not the future I requested.
Just use a DSLR then.
I do.
Perfect. Well, then don't worry about it. Okay. And then everyone else can use their bold glamour filter on TikTok and their teenage view, the teenage version of themselves. All right. So if you're in dark skies and you look up, you're certain to see a satellite. Lots of them. But how can you know which one you're seeing and how can you improve your chances of a sighting? Today we're going to talk about how to see satellites or avoid seeing them. I am ambivalent today because...
That's so unlike you.
I know. I have so much joy, so much happiness seeing satellites as a child... And through even now, I go outside, I look up, I see a satellite. I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
Space.
Yeah. Right?
That could be the Enterprise passing over. But then on the other hand, we know there's more and more and more of them. And they are going to be making our access to space harder.
When was the last time you went out and just spent a night in either a hammock or a lawn chair or... God forbid, actually lying on the ground where there are spiders and just looking at the sky the entire night.
A couple of years to do the whole night. I'll definitely, even now, I'll go outside just, and if it's clear skies, because they're so rare here, the West Coast of Canada this time of year, I go outside and I'm like, oh, it's clear. And then we'll go outside and we'll bundle up and we'll just watch the sky for as long as we can handle it. But yeah, it's been a couple of years for just going outside, laying down under the stars, and I usually pass out in a couple of hours, though, so I'm not built for this.
Yeah, I last went out about a year and a half ago, and so the constellations of satellites were in full swing. We had Starlink was starting to function, and going outside and looking up, trying to see a meteor shower. In Illinois was a matter of look. Oh shoot. Cause it was either a satellite or a lightning bug most of the time.
Now that we don't have, that would be awesome.
The lightning bugs were truly awesome, but the satellites, initially had the exact same feeling as you. And like one of my most powerful memories of Dark Skies was sitting out on a big old rock at the base of a glacier when I was a high schooler and got to go glacier climbing and just watching satellites. Mm-hmm. I had never seen them before. And so this was like what it meant to be someplace truly dark, as you could see satellites. And now it's like, huh, no, they're just there. They're just a lot of them there.
Right. So like describe the experience then. If you're outside, it's a warm summer night, you're lying in the hammock, you're looking up, the sky is clear, the mosquitoes are strangely absent, and you are just
that's
enjoying.
Never going to happen.
I know. You're just enjoying the night sky. And you notice the satellites, what will you see in the sky?
In general, most satellites that you're able to see are like some of the fainter stars, and it looks like a tiny star is moving across the sky. And one of the fascinating things is close to twilight, we'll make it horizon to horizon. Mm-hmm. But as it gets later and later, you can start to tell when they're entering the shadow of the Earth, because they'll be going along, no more. And so there's that, first of all, you have to ask yourself, is it a plane? And the speeds and the solidness of the color, or
right,
the fact that it's blinking from white to not to white,
right,
to not.
Yeah, you see the blinking green light, and
if
that
it's
tells
an airplane.
If it's an airplane. Yeah. Any kind of blinking light that tells you this is an airplane.
And with the satellites, it's going to be sunlight getting reflected back to you. So occasionally there'll be a tumbling satellite, and those you will see variations in brightness, but it's still the color of the sunlight getting reflected back to you the entire time. Now, that going across the sky and turning off, one of the fascinating things is if you're out there and you're just taking in the entire sky, you can actually tell that different satellites are at different orbits, because the ones that are in lower orbits will start hitting the shadow mm-hmm. earlier than the ones that are in
wow.
higher orbits. And if something's in a large enough orbit, it's not going to actually land itself into the shadow of the Earth. And so you can continue watching it throughout the night.
Well, that sort of led into what was going to be my next question, which is like, if you are seeing satellites go overhead, what can you learn just by observing?
So a whole lot. The first thing is we make a certain amount of assumption of how big the satellite is based on how much light it's reflecting back. And this isn't perfect. Some satellites are much shinier than others. Something that is covered in solar cells. So solar cells are designed to absorb sunlight, not reflect it. But to a certain degree, based on how bright it is, you can get an estimate of how large it is. Based on how fast it's moving across the sky, you can start to make assumptions about what orbit it's in. That can get confirmed again by when it does or doesn't hit the shadow of the Earth. And you can tell if it's rotating or not, assuming it isn't symmetric and symmetrically covered in things, based on how it varies in brightness as it goes.
Right. So like that varying of brightness, mm-hmm. I mean, there are ones that you really need dark skies, but if you're in light polluted territory, like many of the people who are listening to this,
yeah.
what can you see?
The International Space Station is only about 400 kilometers up, and it is pretty darn big. It's something that you can actually resolve into a space station with yeah. a middling-sized telescope.
Even binoculars, yeah. With a good yeah. pair of binoculars, you can see the little TIE fighter shape to
yeah.
the space station.
So the space station, it's big, it's low down, it's reflecting a ton of light. That is something you can see fairly easily. The Hubble Space Telescope is actually not that hard to see. It's a little bit higher up and a whole lot tinier, but there are really good predictions for it, and it's shiny. It's reflective, basically.
One of the most exciting things that you can do with this is, if you know there's a launch of Soyuz or Crew Dragon or mm-hmm. you know, one of these Cygnus capsule, you can go out when the, if you're lucky and you're going to get the flyover on your territory, you know, then you can look out with the binoculars and watch as it flies overhead, and you can see the little dot chasing the big bright dot. You can actually see that the spacecraft is docking in space above your head.
If you are in just the right place, you can get multiple passes in one night, and that allows you to see the dots getting closer and closer orbit after orbit.
And that's me. So where I live in Canada, during the summer, the sunlight does sort of illuminate the low Earth orbit for the longer time.
Yeah.
And so I can get three passes of the International Space Station in over the course of an hour and a half. No, 3 hours. So you get one, and then 90 minutes later, you get another one. Is it 90 minutes? 45 minutes?
90-ish.
Hmm. Yeah, and then you get another one. So you get these three passes. And I've never done that. I've never seen it while there's a spacecraft catching it. But it's quite amazing to be able to go outside and see. So then let's talk about, like, this is all random happenstance.
Yeah.
So how do we improve our chances of spotting a satellite, or even starting to find spotting a satellite or finding a specific satellite that we want to see? What do we do?
So the most straightforward thing to do, and it is designed for absolutely anyone to be able to use it, is to go to the Heavens-Above website. And they list prominent, well-known satellites. You tell it where you are. It can tell you when you'll be able to see what passes. And it's really kind of a gateway drug to being a satellite spotter. And it really doesn't get more simple than what Heavens Above allows you to do. Now, you can get as trickstery as you want, however, and there is satellite parsing software in a lot of planetarium software now that allows you to go out and you can see what tracks are going ahead as you're looking at your planetarium software. And if you have the right kind of telescope mount, you can chase those suckers down.
Right. Yeah. One of my favorite things to do, and I've only done this once successfully, is you can go to websites that will let you predict the location of the International Space Station for when it's going to pass in front of the sun or the moon.
Yes.
And so you go out to the place, and it'll tell you where you have to be. So it's a very small area nearby you. And so often it'll recommend some locations you can go within, say, 100 kilometers. And then you go to this exact location at this exact time. And then you record a video of the moon. And then you have, because the station can be in shadow and invisible. Mm-hmm. And so you won't see the space station fly overhead. You just record your image of the moon. And then you go back and you look at the videos that you made and you blow them up. And boom, there goes the space station passing in front of the moon at the exact appointed time, which is just incredible.
And there's some folks out there, Andrew McCarthy comes to mind, who are doing amazing work getting themselves to the right place and using high-end equipment to capture these alignments. And poor Andrew is so good at it that he occasionally gets trolls coming after him saying that it can't be real, and the rate at which things are moving across the moon doesn't make sense. And no, it's just that good.
Yeah, yeah. My favorite is a guy named Thierry Legault. He's in France.
Yeah.
And you could, he's taking pictures that are so good, you can see the astronauts doing a spacewalk on the outside of the International Space Station.
Wow.
It's crazy. So what about Starlinks? Let's say, you know, you've heard that the Starlinks make a trail. How do you see those?
So it depends on how recently they've launched. This is going to sound more complicated, but it always, always works. So there are certain websites that you can go to, and they have catalogs of all the satellites that are out there. CelesTrak is one of the ones that is particularly savvy about having absolutely everything. And NASA provides all the calculators you need to get the observational ephemeris. So you go to CelesTrak, you get what's called a two-line element, which is just the way people share satellite information back and forth. It's super compact, not meant for human brains.
Right.
But then JPL has software that will take in these two-line elements, turn them into ephemeris, and tell you exactly where in the sky at what time you can find these different objects. A lot of times, amateur astronomers will be out there being like, okay, folks, let's go see this. But there, that I have found, there isn't any one place that's like, okay, type in your location and we will tell you exactly when to see every different Starlink trail.
Mm-hmm.
But CelesTrak is a good base.
Yeah, yeah. CelesTrak is terrific. I highly recommend it as well. That and Heavens Above. You need, like, you can only see the Starlinks for a few days after they launch with your eyes. So they start out with the launch and they start at fairly low altitude, and then they are slowly raising their altitude and they're in this train, and you'll have 60 little dots in this line. And over time they're getting farther and farther apart from each other. And then eventually they all dim as they get higher and they get into their final operational altitude, but also their final orientation. So when they're still raising their altitude, they're quite bright, and then they fade away. So, you know, people are always worried about whether or not, like, Starlinks are just going to turn the sky into this grid of little dots, and that is not happening.
Depends on if you're using a telescope
yes.
or not.
Yeah, yeah, no, but just like with your eyes. Like, you walk outside, you look up, you won't see any Starlinks.
Yeah, so go to CelesTrak, type in the satellite that you're interested in, go to JPL Horizons, get the ephemeris.
Yep.
And just go chase.
Yeah, yeah. And it is a lot of fun. And this is why I feel this ambivalence, because, yes, these are human-created light pollution that is going across the sky, but it is really cool to see things that human beings have created and to see them in space and to feel this connection that all the way back to Yuri Gagarin and Sputnik and the Apollo missions and all this kind of stuff. You're seeing humanity's becoming a spacefaring civilization, just like that.
The Starlinks have an entire story in them, because when those trains get launched, they're as you pointed out, they're launched in a lower orbit. This way, if any of them are dead, they just fall back to Earth. No space junk. That is amazing. They then have these ion engines that move so very slowly. TIE fighters had it wrong. And so they're slowly, slowly using particles to boost their orbit, which is an entire other story. And so we're seeing things get launched into a safe orbit and then getting moved into a functional orbit where hopefully the atmosphere won't destroy them too often. And that's something neat to get to share with other humans.
Yeah. 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 It's a fun thing to kind of organize, like both the space station or the Starlink trails. I mean, I wish there were better tools out there to notify you. There are some for sure.
Yeah.
Like, you can get a notification when the space station is going to make a flight overhead.
Yeah. Spot the station from NASA is one that helps.
Yeah.
With that.
And they'll send you like a text message, and you've got like, the station is going to make a fly over your area in 10 minutes. Go outside, and you're like, okay. And then there it is. It's a great party trick. There was an even better party trick, which was the Iridium satellites. Did you ever chase Iridium flares?
Yes, those were fabulous, especially you could see them dawn and dusk occasionally, and there would be this flash brighter than Venus has ever been. If Venus got that bright, we'd be in trouble. And it would flash and then fade as the angle that the sunlight was coming at you changed. The original Iridium satellites were problematic, is the word I'm going to choose to use. And we're not going to go into their abuse of bandwidth, but
they look cool.
They had this amazingly reflective surface, and they'd flare up and fade away. And it wasn't that constant streak. It was this flare that was magnificent.
I would say, you know, when that first generation Iridium satellites were operating, I would say half of the "what did I see in the sky" emails that I would get were explained by Iridium satellites. And the thing that's incredible about them is that you could predict when they were going to flare. And so you could say, okay, look over there, get ready.
Mm-hmm. Boom. It was a party trick.
Yeah, there's the flare. And people are like, whoa.
Yeah. So,
The first generation network is long gone now. Yeah. Satellites are gone. So that party trick is over. Now you've only got the Starlink trails and the International Space Station. All right. So the title of this episode is how to see satellites, but also how to avoid them. How do we avoid seeing satellites?
It's getting harder and harder. And I regret to say that it's starting to become a software problem.
Right.
Yeah. So there are currently satellites crossing the sky in almost every direction. Not literally every direction, because going against the rotation of the planet kind of is hard to get into, even if you were space debris. Mm-hmm. But we have polar orbits. We have all manner of inclination between 0 and 90. So you have things going around the equator and around the poles and everywhere in between. Mm-hmm. Now, luckily, once you start looking away from the equator late at night, the probability you're going to have things, especially in the winter, goes down, 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 because things aren't going to be as much in the sunlight. They're going to be in the shadow of the Earth. And we luckily don't put things in really large, highly inclined orbits. So since they're closer to the planet generally, not always, there's Russian communication satellites and things like that. The Malyanka orbits will screw you up. But other than that...
So the thing that we mentioned as the way to see satellites, go during the time when your nights are the shortest and your dawn and dusk are the longest to see satellites. So do the opposite. Mm-hmm. Go out at the time when the night is the longest and the dawn and the dusk are the shortest, which for us in the Northern Hemisphere means wintertime. December 21st is going to be the longest night, the shortest day.
Yeah.
And also the coldest. So it's sort of too bad, but I mean, no matter where you go. And look away from the equator. So to maximize your chance of not having any satellites in the sky is to see during the wintertime on the longest night you can. And then the time. So you most likely see the satellites at dawn and dusk. So avoid dawn and dusk. Go observe deep into astronomical night. So, like, when would you start? Like, if you want to guarantee it's December 21st and you want to make sure that you don't see any satellite trails, when would you open up the light to your telescope?
Oh man, I would want to go as far north as I could while still having good weather in December, which is an interesting set of variables. And probably 3 hours after sunset. Right. So well after astronomical twilight, just because that will get rid of all the lower orbits.
Right.
For the
most
part.
Gets dark for you at six, start observing at nine.
Yeah. And yeah, it's frustrating. And this is where I think that isn't always going to be practical. We can't throw away that much of the night if we're trying to do science. So what you end up doing is where you might have taken 10 images of a target in the past and stacked them together into your image. Now you're going to be taking 13 or 14 so that all those satellite streaks that are cutting through your image are something that you can get rid of. And one of the annoying things is, while all of this works for optical telescopes, infrared telescopes are going to be cursed because infrared you can still see because the satellites are warm.
Right. They're warmed up by the sun, and so they pass through your field of view. And I mean, I think people who are listening to this are wondering, like, isn't there software that you can use?
Yeah.
And the answer is absolutely. You can, as an amateur astrophotographer, the problem of removing artifacts from your pictures is as old as the hobby. Removing airplane trails, removing satellite trails, you throw out the frame that has the picture in it.
You don't even throw out the whole frame. So you throw out the pixels. What you do is called min-max rejection, or that's just one of the equations. There's lots of different ways, but min-max is the easiest one to explain, and it's super effective for this. Basically, you say, okay, I took 15 images. I am going to get rid of the 5 brightest no matter what for a given pixel. So you do this on a pixel by pixel basis. I get rid of however many on the low end makes sense for your particular detector, and then I combine everything in the middle. And what this does is it gets rid of your cosmic rays because they're going to vary from pixel to pixel each time. It gets rid of your satellites.
There are cosmic rays going through your picture. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's so cool. But also they're annoying.
They're super annoying, especially the glancing blow ones because they look more like lightning. Min-max rejection.
Right. So the point is algorithmically, you can run your astrophotography through these algorithms. You can remove the star trails, the plane trails, if that's what you want, or make a fun picture that shows all of the trails all at the same time to leave those in, and you can see just how much they're crossing your pictures. It is a minor annoyance, and it's getting a little bit worse, but it is not causing a lot of damage to the work of astrophotographers. But where the area is significant is in the for the work of actual professional astronomers. And, you have limited time on this really powerful telescope.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking a picture of this specific galaxy. You need a very, very long exposure image to get the spectroscopic data. You were only able to take 10 images of the galaxy, and one of them has a giant satellite trail going right through it, and you have to throw it out. It's worthless.
There are maths that are saying that it's going to increase the amount of observing time needed on a target from several percent to 10%-ish.
Yeah.
And that's a lot. That means potentially several percent to 10% less science completed.
Right. And the halfway solution is back to the thing you mentioned earlier on, which is ephemeris. Right now, there's no rules and regulations about launching the satellites as with respect to astronomers. And there's no requirement for the satellite operators to tell astronomers where their satellites are so that they can organize their observations around it. There was a paper that I read where they said that you could remove almost in all of the effect of the satellites in astronomical images from a trailing standpoint, not the sky glow side, that's a whole other issue, by providing really accurate locations and orbits of the satellites. And so the astronomer knows, okay, don't take the picture for 1 second. Wait 1 second before taking the picture, and the satellite will have moved away from the object that I'm observing, and then take the picture.
And it's going to become a hot mess at some point where you have algorithms set up so you know I can do 90 seconds, pause, do 120 seconds, pause. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to figure it out.
Yeah. And that, like the satellite, and this is my... people always have this, what I think is a fairly emotional reaction to the existence of these satellites. And for me, the thing that should have happened was the satellite operators and the astronomers got together and they came up with a set of rules for how to minimize the impact on science. And that conversation was never had.
No.
And the astronomers could have had a voice and could have had these could have put in a bunch of recommendations that the government could have then made the satellite operators adhere to. And we would be in a place where we would still have almost the same amount of high-speed communications around the Earth, and the astronomers would be able to get almost the same amount of the science that they're doing today. And that never happened, which makes me frustrated.
Yeah, we were both at the 2020 AAAS meeting, which was right after Starlink had started putting up trains. And the outrage was palpable because we just didn't see it coming. And radio astronomy has worked hard to try and get service providers to shut off their broadcasts while over various radio sites, radio astronomy sites. But with optical telescopes, we can't turn off the sun's reflection as readily.
Right.
So we're kind of stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Anyway, it's a, you know, obviously it's an ongoing issue, and I'm sure we'll be reporting on it when we get to the final 30,000 satellites in various constellations and so on. Like it will be an unfolding issue, but there is no putting this horse back in the barn.
Genie back in the bottle.
We are proceeding to this new world with tens of thousands of low Earth orbit satellites at the same time trying to do science from the ground.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pamela.
And thank you, Fraser. And thank you so much to everyone out in our audience who supports us through Patreon. I wish we could thank all of you, but we can't. But this week, I'm going to thank at least some of you. So thank you to Scott Cohn, Kimberly Reich, Daniel Loosely, Marco Iarassi, Matthew Horstman, DFM, Jeff Wilson, Gregory Singleton, Philip Walker, Tim Garish, Matthias Hayden, Claudia Mastriani, Justin Proctor, Tim McMacken, Kensaya Pimflenko, Disastrina Cooper, Veronica Cure, Benjamin Mueller, Omar Del Riviera, J. Alex Alexanderson, Iran Zegrev, Kenneth Ryan, Don Mundus, Michelle Cullen, Dean McDaniel, Paul D. Disney, Scott Briggs, Ninja Nick, Sharsom, Michael Regan, Peter, Matt Rucker, Jim McGeehan, Frodo Tenenbaugh, Father Prax, Brent Krenop, Philip Grand, Antisaurus, Bruce Amazine, Mark Steven Rasnick, Abraham Cottrell, Dwight Ilk, and Smansky. Thank you all.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
See y'all. Bye-bye.
Astronomy Cast is a joint product of Universe Today and the Planetary Science Institute. Astronomy Cast is released under a Creative Commons attribution license. So love it, share it, and remix it. But please, credit it to our hosts, Fraser Cain and Dr. Pamela Gay. You can get more information on today's show topic on our website, astronomycast.com. This episode was brought to you thanks to our generous patrons on Patreon. If you want to help keep this show going, please consider joining our community at patreon.com/astronomycast. Not only do you help us pay our producers a fair wage, you will also get special access to content right in your inbox and invites to online events. We are so grateful to all of you who have joined our Patreon community already. Anyways, keep looking up. This has been Astronomy Cast.